We have plans for informational meeting today only. First off is the Oregon Plan Review by the Department of Environmental Quality. And see, we have Jim McCulley, Legislative Coordinator for the Department, and Greg Aldrich, Manager of the Watershed Management Section. And that's correct?
That's correct.
Okay, gentlemen, at your pleasure.
Okay, super. Thank you very much, Chairman Jensen. Members of the other committee members, my name is Jim McCulley here representing DEQ today, Legislative Coordinator. We've been asked today to provide an update on DEQ's progress and efforts within the Oregon Plan. Greg Aldrich accompanies me and will be providing primary updates on TMDL program, or the Total Maximum Daily Load program within the state of Oregon. As you know, DEQ's primary role in this statewide effort has been one related to development of clean water plans, also known as a Total Maximum Daily Load. These plans are required for any impaired waters within the state, and I think the easiest thing at this point is to let Greg start with his presentation, and I'll be able to close with a few remarks about a watershed approach and linkage within a couple of multiple programs within DEQ.
Okay.
Thank you, Jim, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, I am Greg Aldrich with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and the manager of the Watershed Management Section. And of course, today I'm here to talk about how the Total Maximum Daily Load program helps to implement the Oregon Plan at DEQ. Overview of today's presentation. First, I'd like to define what a TMDL is. As Jim said, a Total Maximum Daily Load, or another way of describing it is a clean water plan. I'd like to talk about the status of TMDL development statewide, and then finally about TMDL implementation, where there's a difference made on the ground. To begin with, what we're doing is protecting water quality, and this is based off of the Clean Water Act set by Congress and then incorporated in various state statutes and state rules. First, we set statewide water quality standards. These are based on beneficial uses such as temperature for fish or dissolved oxygen for fish or human contact for bacteria. Then we monitor water quality and find out whether or not stream segments meet the water quality standards. And for my presentation, I'll keep talking about stream segments, but remember that that applies to the large rivers as well as ponds as well as lakes and like that. So just generically, we call them stream segments here. When we find an impairment or when the water body water stream does not meet the standard, we then list it on the 303D list, which is classification from the Clean Water Act. And that is a trigger that requires the development of a total maximum daily load, or another way of looking at it is a pollution budget to bring that stream back into compliance with the standards. Then once we have done that, then the next and final step is to implement that TMDL to restore water quality and make sure there is a difference on the ground and we see it when we monitor water quality in the future. So how do we develop a TMDL? Traditionally, DEQ works with the technical and policy participants to determine how much pollution the stream can take and still meet water quality standards. Of course, because we're doing a TMDL, we already know that the stream has more pollution in it than meets standards. So what we're looking at is how do we come up with reductions or how much reduction is needed to meet water quality standards, and then how do we divide that pie of how much pollution can actually go in the river or stream and still meet standards. How do we divide that pie of pollution amongst the various stakeholder groups out there, whether they're the point source or the non-point source sectors? And then finally, as we think about that, we also want to be able to accommodate new or expanding sources because obviously we're in a state that's growing. Cities are growing, so the wastewater treatment plants are growing. Industry is growing, and they need the opportunity to have increased or new discharges. So to think about our maximum daily load, next one, we have an equation, and it basically is, like I said, a pollution budget. So the total maximum daily load equals how much pollution is allocated to the point sources, and point sources you think of as sewage treatment plants and industries, how much goes to the non-point sources, so they're the traditional sources that do not discharge through a pipe, conveyance into the river, but through generally runoff across the land. And examples include urban runoff, agricultural runoff, forestry runoff, runoff from highways, as well as other natural processes. Since we recognize that we don't know everything, we include a margin of safety, and that provides for the unknowns or incomplete data we may have. So we set aside often some small portion of that allocation, either implicitly or explicitly, to the equation. Implicitly means we include conservative assumptions, and explicitly says we actually set some number aside. And then finally, as I mentioned before, we recognize future growth is important, so we want to set aside a part of the TMDL equation for the ability to accommodate future growth. So once we've done that, we've essentially completed the TMDL development process, and next comes implementation. And what's important is the role of other agencies, as well as DEQ, to lead implementation and make a difference on the ground. So one of the major groups that we talk about are the designated management agencies, or DMAs. And these are federal, state, or local government agencies that has legal authority over a sector or source contributing pollutants, and is identified by such by DEQ, and it's listed in the TMDL. DMAs are responsible for implementing the management strategies and developing and revising sector-specific or source-specific implementation plans. So what this really means is for any given city or county, traditionally they need to develop some type of TMDL implementation plan that says what they're going to do to meet water quality standards for those sources and those activities that they have jurisdiction over. As many of you probably know, there's two separate components, and for agriculture we have the Senate Bill 1010 process that's in statute, and for state forestry we use the Forest Practice Act. So DEQ basically works with the cities and counties and other agencies, and then for agriculture, statute gives the Department of Agriculture the lead, and for forestry, statute gives ODF the lead. So this is how it all comes together when we talk about designated management agencies and plan implementation, plan being the TMDL implementation plan. So we look at, in the center, what are those water quality management plans or implementation plans that are going to be required that will achieve water quality standards and goals in the long run. And then what we see listed across the rest of the slide are the major players who are involved in many of our TMDLs, who have control over some sector or part of the environment where they need to make changes or work with their own constituents to cause change. Army Corps of Engineers, particularly if you think about the massive dam systems on the Willamette or on the Columbia, federal land managers such as the Bureau BLM or U.S. Forest Service, again, agriculture and forestry through our own state departments, as well as point sources, which are controlled by DEQ. And, of course, the other thing DEQ works with are the urban and rural non-point sources, traditionally the local governments. And, of course, throughout this whole process, there's opportunities for the public and other interested parties to participate. The premise of our TMDL implementation is based on adaptive management. We create a plan, and we're creating a lot of them at this point in time. And, of course, we don't know everything. We don't understand everything. So we implement what's known as adaptive management, which is a process that ensures that we'll seek improvement over time. And what you're seeing at the top level is the current level of, say, pollution. And down lower, you'll see on the side, I'll say WQS or water quality standards. And what we're looking at is how to go from the current level of pollution and drop that over time so eventually we'll meet the water quality standards. And we know that we'll develop plans now in conjunction with other agencies and like that on our best information we have today. And we'll be checking in traditionally on a 5-year cycle to see are we Are we doing the right things? Do we need to modify those plans? If things are working as we plan, we don't need to make any changes. If things are going better or not as well as we plan, then maybe we need to make changes. But we want to keep our focus on meeting the water quality standard at some horizon year. And that horizon year could be 5 years out there for some pollutants, and it could be 50 or 100 years out there when you start thinking about temperature or mercury.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So this is future, looking into the future.
Yes.
Can you tell us what you've done in the past in managing the water quality?
Okay. Through the chair, there are programs being implemented both by DEQ and elsewhere across the state that are managing water quality and making improvements in water quality. What we're doing at this point in time, and if maybe we can take the Willamette, since the one that is a TMDL that people are talking about that affect the Salem area, is at this point in time we've done a pollution study, the TMDL analysis, and we have an idea of that snapshot in time of the last couple of years of what is the level of pollution, who are the major contributors, and what are the likely ways to reduce that pollution. So now we're sort of looking from this point forward, given knowing that this is what's gotten us to this problem, and then we're looking forward into how we can solve that problem. Now, for other basins, say maybe the Rogue or the Deschutes, where we haven't started or haven't gotten as far along in the TMDL, there's activities occurring now that can be reducing how much pollution are going into those watersheds. So when the TMDL is actually completed, the level of reduction may be less than if the TMDL were done today or had been done 5 years ago. I don't know if I've answered your question.
Well, I guess I was just wanting to look backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To see what improvements have been made, but it sounds like that's not in your purview.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's okay.
Chair. I'll get to that in a couple of minutes and talk about some successes if I could.
Thank you. That's fine.
Sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Go ahead.
Going on to the next slide. This is our target completion dates for TMDL statewide. And we're really talking here about the initial round of TMDLs. TMDLs that were identified for impaired water bodies either in the late 90s or earlier, in, say, 2002. So we know that there could be future impairments found and there could be future TMDLs needed. But right now, we're doing the first major round of TMDLs statewide. And this is the plan to get us through that whole cycle through 91 subbasins statewide by 2010.
Do you have a copy
of this attached?
Do we have a color copy of that?
Yes.
The last page.
Attached to the presentation at the end.
Got it. Thank
okay.
you.
So what I want to show is on our current schedule, the yellow represents TMDLs that have been completed, submitted to EPA, and then approved by EPA. And the only ones that count are the ones that are approved by EPA. So you'll see sectors of the state where they've been completed, such as the Umatilla, Upper Grand Ronde, the North Coast area, Klamath Falls area. Then the other colors represent the year that the TMDL will be completed. So you'll see a lot of blue, which represents 2005, and those are the major TMDLs underway, obviously at this point in time. The most notable ones in this area, the Willamette, the Umpqua, and the Rogue. And then other colors represent what are our targets up through 2010. And again, we do TMDLs not just on the sub-basin level, but on the basin level. So if you look at larger groupings together, we look at the entire Deschutes sub-basin or the entire Willamette whenever possible, not just, say, the middle Willamette or the upper Willamette, so we get a better idea of how the entire watershed works.
Can you tell me how you get how you've arrived at these different dates, 2005, 2006, 2000, whatever?
Yes, back when the original schedule was developed in the early or the late 1990s, we looked at priorities and we looked at where the largest concentration of pollution were, and those were the main factors went into here's the areas we should focus on first, here are areas we should focus on later in the the time frame. So what you'll see, either through the yellow or particularly under the blue, is you'll see areas where there are perceived problems, particularly a lot of the more urbanized, industrialized part of the state. And what you'll see out in the far out time frames are more of the non-point source areas where we probably have a single major type of pollutant out there, like, say, sediment or temperature, where there's less listings per geographic area, less stakeholders, or less interaction between the non-point source and the point source.
The yellow, doesn't strike me as being the populated part of the state.
You were correct on that. And those were some of our earliest ones, and I think they were sort of getting the process working and up and going. What's not shown here is we also did TMDLs before this round. There were some TMDLs done in the 1990s. Some examples would be Bear Creek down in the Medford area, the Tualatin in the Portland metro area, which are more heavily populated industrial areas. Now you see a need to do new TMDLs in some of those areas, and it's because there have been new pollutants identified that we've had to address.
So we're looking at a process which really began in the middle to the latter portion of the last of the preceding decade, right? 1990s?
Yes.
And we're halfway through the 2000 to 2010. And fundamentally, unless we complete all of the blue in 2005, we really haven't gotten too large a portion of the TMDLs done.
For approval, that is correct, Mr. Chair.
What's been the biggest problem as far as the delay of this or the time element? Why is it taking so long?
The current round of TMDLs really, if I may, just go on to the next slide, because we talk about the consent decree with some of the major stakeholders that really forced EPA and the state to be committed to the TMDL development schedule and to complete them. So TMDLs, I believe, not only in the state but nationwide, we did not devote as much energy to them back in the 90s or in the 80s. And with the consent decree and our agreements with EPA and then with the Oregon plan and additional resources that came through that, the agency was able to staff up and actually get into a major commitment to TMDL development, and that's what you're seeing now. So the plan really represents what's happening from the year 2000 through 2010. And the consent decree requires that the initial round of TMDLs be completed by 2010, and the consent decree has set milestones for the year 2004, 2008, and 2010 of how many TMDL segments, and that's how it's counted in the consent decree, have to be completed to meet the intent of the court. And then the requirement for 2010 is that we complete 1,153 TMDL segments at that point in time. At this point, at the end of 2004, EPA has approved 437 of those TMDL segments, which means we've met the 2004 target and we're on our way to hopefully meeting the 2008 target. As you mentioned in that map, and if you could go back, please. The blue that represents the Willamette and the Umpqua are two examples of TMDLs that have taken a long time to develop. The Willamette TMDL actually came out for public comment was released for public comment in October. Comment period closed at the end of January. So that was a major hurdle of releasing that TMDL. We're now in the process of responding to those comments with our goal of actually submitting it to EPA, hopefully this summer with approval. So that will be the biggest TMDL we've completed in the state. The Umpqua is probably maybe 4 to 5 months behind in terms of its process and should be out for public comment hopefully by July. So again, when you look at 2006, you should see big chunks of the state turning from that blue into yellow, and hopefully much more than just those two basins I just talked about. But these studies, particularly because of the Willamette and the Umpqua, so many point sources, so many non-point sources, much population, a lot of participants, constituents, they have taken a long time to go through the process and reach some level of consensus for going forward.
In your professional estimation or judgment, are you on schedule, ahead of schedule, behind schedule for completion of everything by the target date of 2010?
With the current resources we have and seeming ongoing success as we've been able to, sort of the way we are putting together TMDLs, going through the stakeholder and process, et cetera, I think I'm comfortable to say we should be hitting that target for the year 2010. We're slightly ahead of the 2004 target, and with the big TMDLs such as the Willamette and the Umpqua coming in, which are rich in terms of how many TMDL segments are in them. The Willamette itself has about 150. Those, some people would want to call them beams. They will add a lot to meeting that consent decree. What happens is once we start moving into the eastern part of the state, particularly the John Day and farther east, there's a lot of geographic coverage out there. The number of TMDL segments drop considerably. So even though it looks like we'll be ahead in numbers for the next couple of years, there's a lot of work with constituents and with the process that will take quite a bit of time, but the reward at the end of each TMDL in terms of meeting the consent decree will be slightly less because there are less segments. Obviously, the great reward is improving water quality, and that's the ultimate goal if you set aside the consent decree.
Go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. If we can go on to significant accomplishments.
There we go.
So what's happened in this biennium, 2003 to 2005, and the good news is we've met the first consent decree, as I've mentioned. We have completed the Lower Columbia Sandy TMDL in the Portland metro area, and that should be going out to EPA, we think, next week. We are working on responsive comments for the Willamette TMDL, and we hope, like I said, hope to have that off to EPA this summer. We got 70 sets of comments. Some of those comments were up to 70 pages long, so there's quite a bit of effort of going through them, looking at the issues, seeing how to address them properly, and then reaching closure on this. And again, as I said, we hope to have the Umpqua out for late spring for public comment. The other thing about the Willamette TMDL, it was the first major TMDL under our new temperature standard, and I think you may have heard about the temperature standard through some of the other committee meetings. But there was a new one approved by EPA last year, and there's some fairly major changes that stopped us in the Willamette and made us go back and reexamine what the new temperature standard means and how to incorporate that in a TMDL that has extensive temperature considerations and then move forward. So that's been a big effort, but hopefully it's beyond that. It was the first TMDL effort to reflect a basin-wide approach. So again, we weren't just looking at the upper Grand Ronde or the Umatilla. We're trying to look at almost the entire Willamette as one unified entity. And then it was the first TMDL to look at mercury in the state of Oregon. And then the last one I want to...
Why was that... Pardon? Why was this the first TMDL to look at mercury?
We had other TMDLs that are scheduled, except for the Snake River, where we, which is a joint effort with the state of Idaho, and we did not have enough information data to go forward. For the Willamette, it was the first major TMDL to come along with mercury listings, and we've done that. There's some other mercury listings that we'll have to address in the future. So when you look at where the yellows were on that map, there just were not mercury listings that we had to consider.
You're saying there was no mercury in the waters there?
No, Mr. Chair. To do a TMDL, it means there's an impairment, which means there's some exceedance of a standard, either a numeric standard or a biological, I'm sorry, a a narrative standard, and in those basins there was not something that said we had a mercury problem. Not saying there's not mercury in them, or that at a future date we may not discover that there's a mercury problem there. But in the Willamette, we had clear evidence of a mercury problem. It was on the list of impaired water bodies, so we are addressing it as part of all the other impairments in the Willamette. Okay. I'm afraid I'm not addressing your question, though.
No, not really. But go ahead. We'll get back.
Okay. And the other significant accomplishment this year is working with the state of California on the Klamath Lost River TMDLs. It's a bi-state effort because the water bodies cross the state line. Actually, the Lost River crosses the state line several times. So those are the major things we're working on now, and then gearing up. When you looked at the map, you saw the Rogue and the Deschutes. Many efforts are going on them, but it'll be a while before those come out for public comment. So that brings us to significant efforts for this coming biennium, and that would be the completion of the Willamette, the Umpqua, and the Klamath and Lost TMDLs. Also, we expect completion of the Rogue and the Illinois, which is part of the Rogue Basin, the Chetco on the south coast, the Walla Walla, what we call the Wallala Northeast Corner, which includes the Imnaha and Lower Grand Ron, as well as the Malal Pudding, which is one part of the Willamette that wasn't completed as part of the current TMDL. And then we expect to continue major work on the Deschutes, the John Day, and the Yamhill TMDLs. And then going to post-2007 for future bienniums, as I mentioned earlier, there will be fewer TMDL in any given year because there are fewer TMDL or impaired waters listings per basin. However, the level of effort needed to develop a TMDL that will not change significantly. The geographic size of the remaining basins are much larger, so the territory to cover, just thinking about going to meetings, meeting with stakeholders, collecting data, size does make a big difference. Also, the effort needed to maintain the involvement of affected parties is very important, and it's a cornerstone of our TMDLs, and we want to continue that into the future. And then the other thing we know is going to happen is new TMDLs will be needed to reflect new impaired stream listings. As required by the Clean Water Act, every 2 years, the state waters are evaluated against standards, so we're looking at new monitoring data against the standard, so it could be the existing standard or if a standard was modified and we have a new standard. And if there are new impaired waters, we have to eventually develop TMDLs to address those. And of course, as part of the TMDL implementation, we want to conduct reviews on pretty much a 5 and a 10 year cycle to see the progress we're making. Are implementation plans working? Are there new issues coming up? Are there successes that we can acknowledge? And then what we see into the future is increased focus on implementation. So as we get closer to 2010 and we've done the first major round of TMDLs, which should be the most of the pollution issues we're going to face, at least in the near future, the real focus goes on to making sure implementation is occurring across the state, and we're seeing successes and hopefully reaching that goal of meeting water quality standards statewide. So TMDL's implementation, and like to say, it's making a difference. TMDLs indicate how much pollution reduction is needed. TMDL implementation is a pathway to achieve those reductions. Permits and plans call for changes. So if for the point sources who have permits, say for temperature in the Willamette, there'll be changes to their permits to represent new temperature limits that need to be implemented that will help cool the river, or for other parameters is appropriate. Again, plans would be developed that will hopefully change what's happening on the ground so less pollution will end up in the river, so the river will be cleaner in the future. Again, we'll be doing the 5-year check-ins to verify if progress is being made. Again, the cornerstone is the need to use adaptive management. Are changes needed or are the plans as developed working? And if they're not working, why and what can we do about that? And again, DEQ staff leads this effort, though there's lots of participants in it, the cities, the counties, other federal agencies, and of course our interaction with both Department of Agriculture and the Department of Forestry. But still, DEQ staff lead the effort, make the coordination happen, and evaluate results and like that to make sure things are working. And then if I could talk a little bit about TMDL successes, I could want to go to the next slide. And what you're seeing on the statewide map is a series of dots, and the dots represent long-term water quality monitoring sites across the state. And there's approximately 150 of them there. And then the stars there, there are 10 of them, represent 10 sites within the state with the greatest improvement that's occurred in that time period of collecting water data and analyzing it between 1990 and 2003. The shaded areas represent TMDL sub-basins that were completed and have significant improvements have been made. So what you're seeing is the Yamhill from a previous TMDL that was completed before the year 2000, the Tualatin, which had TMDLs done in the 1990s, and then another big one done in 2001, and then Bear Creek, which was done, I believe, in the late 90s, down in the Medford area. And what you're seeing is 9 out of the 10 stars are actually, they represent the areas in the state where we're seeing the most significant improvement in terms of water quality. So we do believe that TMDLs are making a difference. And of course, as we said, this data is from work that was done a number of years ago because there's a long lead time in making these water quality changes to implement a TMDL. To update coin source permits can take a 5-year cycle to make sure that changes are occurring on the ground from city stormwater runoff or from agriculture or forestry can take a number of years to implement changes and then to see corresponding improvements in water quality. And then finally, just wanted to touch a little bit on the Willamette River TMDL and its implementation, because as I said, we hope to send that to complete that, issue it as a TMDL by the department, and then send it to EPA for their final review and approval. And it's a significant effort, as you can imagine. It's over 2 million people live in it. 70% of the industry in the state is in there, major agriculture and forestry components. There are over 100-plus designated management agencies, so those are all the cities and counties that are in the valley, as well as the Corps of Engineers, as well as a number of other federal and state agencies. So there's a lot of work to be done to implement improvements in the Willamette. As you probably know, there's a policy option package that was submitted by DEQ for consideration as part of our budget request this year, which includes 2 basin coordinators. Those are the folks who actually look at data, meet with stakeholders, help to figure out how to resolve problems and like that. Stormwater specialists, when you think of all the cities out there in particular, how to deal with stormwater, particularly the smaller cities who don't have all the expertise on staff. Compliance assistance specialists, and then halftime for Mercury. Because for Mercury, we realize that there's an ongoing effort to better understand issues in the Willamette. And then my last slide is reports that we submit quarterly to the Legislative Fiscal Office. These are reports that come out of our 2003 budget note, quarterly updates on what's happening in the TMDL program, both development and implementation. It also is an update on federal requirements and litigation that would be affecting the program. And included in your package is the latest one that was sent out for February 1st of this year. And if you need earlier ones, we can certainly get copies to you. But this is what's routinely submitted, and it's received both by Legislative Fiscal Office as well as Department of Administrative Service and their Budget Office. So I believe there's a few more questions. But thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Got any questions? If we're to measure, in the department, or try to measure in the department your success with this TMDL program, at this point, the only measurements we have are how many you've gotten, where you're at on the original time schedule, sort of thing, which, you know, I suppose as a type of measurement is fine, but, you know, with the basic objective of what's this all about, what kind of plans do we have? What kind of measurements can you give us or look for, or should we be looking for? I have, you know, as an example, the feeling that if we restore runs in the MNAHA to a pre Lewis and Clark period, that we're still going to be behind as far that that has nothing to do really with the process that we're going through. What is there in measurable criteria that will enable us to tell whether this is a meaningful exercise, other than we have met this more or less ambiguous or vague TMDL definition?
If I could, we actually have two program-specific measures that I know have been presented to the as part of the Ways and Means discussion. And one is compliance with the consent decree. Another one looks at that ratio of how many miles are listed for impairment. So go back to that list of impaired water bodies or streams and our success in completing TMDLs. But I agree both of those are administrative. I think the best measure we're going to have over time, and I emphasize over time, is going to be the actual water quality monitoring, our water quality index of are we seeing changes and are we reaching the point of meeting the water quality standards, whether it's the Willamette River in the city of Portland or the Willamette River near Albany or, as you say, a stream in the Hob Basin. As part of the TMDL process, there is an examination of standards also to see if there are local conditions that suggest the standard no longer applies. There's not the appropriate number for that area. And a lot of people like to talk about the temperature standards, a good example, can we ever achieve, and the number people usually use is 64 degrees. Well, as part of the TMDL analysis, we may actually determine that a stream in the summer would never reach 64 degrees, even in its natural state before Lewis and Clark came. And that's something the TMDL can acknowledge and say, we never expect that river to, we'll never see that river achieve 64 degrees in those summer months. And that's okay, and to me, to be successful, it may be meeting a higher temperature. And that's part of what the TMDL helps us to understand is, yes, there are different conditions across the state that suggest that the standards, statewide standards, may need to be reexamined for unique conditions across the state. And temperature is the one I think most people think about, because we all agree that not every stream in the state can meet 64 degrees all the time, and a lot of our analysis totally supports that and says that other numbers are appropriate. So when we go back and compare numbers at a later date, we won't be looking for 64 degrees on some of those streams. We'll be looking for a different number to say, oh, we've reached success, and it's going to be at a different checkpoint.
Well, I was delaying or hesitant to bring up the temperature issue because that is something that is fraught with controversy.
Right.
And there certainly are many streams in the state that, to put it gently, will seldom during the summer months make the standards, whether we're talking about 2005 or whether we're talking about 1805. I mean, it's hard to get 64 degree temperature in a stream where it's 110 in the shade and there is no shade, sort of thing. So, and that's a lot of area.
Could I add one more thing?
Sure. Please.
Another thing on temperature, and as we look at temperature, particularly away from the main stream, you know, the main stem of a river, so if you think of the Willamette or the Columbia, but you look at the smaller rivers that flow in or the tributaries, where we actually do a lot less technical analysis just because it's a large state, What we do look for is, though, what is, and temperature as an example, is what is the appropriate level of vegetation, because a lot of the issues out there about stream warming have to do with vegetation and how much vegetation has been lost over time and for what reasons. And that's not to imply in the future that a stream, particularly in the eastern part of the state, should have, you know, be tree-lined the entire distance. But what we do look at, both DEQ and with other collaborators in the TMDL development process, look at what is reasonable, what would be there naturally, and how can we reach that natural condition. And then that the measure would be, okay, we've restored those riparian corridors, a certain level of vegetation, which you may never see the stream go back to, as you say, will never reach 64 degrees. It may not even get below 70 degrees, but we know that we've cooled it as much as natural as possible and hopefully still maintain the other needs, other uses of the land in that area. So there's other measures just besides what you can pull out in terms of, you know, the water temperature or how many consent decree targets we've met. So in case for vegetation, it could be how many miles of vegetation have been restored, trees planted or allowed to grow, and things like that. And those would be adequate for judging success also.
Let's go ahead, and if you're finished, then we'll get back to the questions when we...
Right. Again, Mr. Chair, Jim McCauley here. I wanted to just close with a few comments on some cross-program or essentially some integration of how this TMDL program fits with one of DEQ's changes that are presently occurring and will occur in much greater detail. We've been looking at methods as an agency that would provide for an improvement in our overall delivery of the wastewater program statewide. And many of these elements have been linked to a combination of streamlining efforts, just flat-out improved program delivery, and an improvement in how new information is incorporated into new permits. Another equally important factor in that conversation has been the integration of multiple programs to achieve an end result. And in the case of the Oregon Plan, DEQ's goal is improved water quality statewide. Now, in order to help connect DEQ's efforts under the Oregon Plan, I think it's probably helpful to describe DEQ's work in starting in 02 that established a group known as the Blue Ribbon Committee. This group represents a diverse set of interests that included business and industry, municipal facilities, consulting engineers, environmental interests, and community leaders. Within a span of about 18 months in 2004, the group was able to provide a final set of recommendations for DEQ to help us improve the overall wastewater program. And these recommendations specifically related to a watershed approach and include the following concepts. One was a cyclic watershed-based approach to most permitting and compliance activities to bring about a better permit planning and follow-up, as well as an integration with other water quality programs and activities, such as our TMDL program that Greg just got through describing. We wanted to prepare a watershed-based permit plan that would essentially improve our overall work effort, as well as improve the timeliness of how those permits are being renewed in the future and incorporating new information as well. Three, the process for determining the resources that DEQ devoted to that permit application was based on the environmental significance of that permit within a watershed, and this process would allow DEQ to assign limited resources appropriately while assuring that we have adequate coverage for the full suite of wastewater permits that we have statewide and specifically within watershed basins. Now, the connection of the permitting program to the Oregon Plan is really a very good example for our program integration. From a broad sense, DEQ will be able to link future development of the wastewater permitting with the results of these clean water plans, or TMDLs, the total maximum daily load. DEQ believes this watershed approach is going to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of of our environmental programs and services by implementing many of our programs in a more integrated manner, according really to more of a watershed cycle or a physical process.
Excuse me, Jim. Could you give an example of how this permitting process would differ from your traditional NPDES, National Pollution Discharge System, and also, just an example would be helpful. And, you know, are you going to then change the scope of the mixing zones for the permit? And how exactly is it going to change what you currently are doing?
Right. Thank you, Vice Chair Dingfelder. The basic concept is that historically when DEQ has gone through a permitting process and then a renewal schedule is each time the permit comes up for renewal in, a five-year cycle, it's renewed at that point in time. And that's done independently in many cases of the permit that might be downriver or another one that might be connected further downstream or something of that nature. Under this approach, when we come up for renewals in the future on existing permits and when new permits are integrated into the system, we're going to be able to look at the entire watershed and essentially look at the suite of all the permits that are within this sub-basin level, essentially very comparable to the map that Greg had showed earlier with the, in terms of the TMDL schedule. So in the future, when permit applicants come up for renewal, they won't literally be around the table at one time, but in a at least a sense of being in the room and being able to decide what those allocations are going to look like for pollutant discharge, as well as being able to update any new standards that we physically have. Modifications within their permits would take place as well, and we'll be able to have a direct linkage and integration into the TMDL and physically be able to meet those load allocations at a point in time.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. And then how does water marketing for trading of credits, because I know that we had a pilot project, didn't we, on the Willamette that was voted in a couple of sessions ago. How would that fit in with the watershed approach? Are you going to be looking at that then for each watershed or based on the results of the pilot project in the Willamette? And I don't know if you can share that now or want to come back to this committee and talk about that.
Vice Chair Dingfelder, thank you very much. I think the way to look at the trading issue, essentially what that involves for other members of the committee who maybe aren't quite familiar, is you would have one applicant getting together with another applicant and deciding amongst themselves how they could best approach their next permit renewal. And under this watershed approach, this really helps initiate those types of conversations so that overall, or as multiple applicants get together, their overall level of pollution that would be entering the system through this wastewater permitting would effectively meet whatever load allocation or essentially reduce. Now, we've got an excellent example out there that's already been done with Clean Water Services out of Portland, and they physically are now under one permit for multiple facilities, whereas historically they had individual permits, so they had some ability even within their own projects or within their own facilities to be able to do some trading. And we fully expect this is going to help initiate these types of conversations in the future. There's a report that we've produced annually, and we'd be more than happy to make a distribution to the committee.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Tolman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All of this is so new to me, and I'm just trying to understand this, and I just over lunch had a meeting regarding the new city of Damascus. So could you explain to me how the city of Damascus will be going through the process that you've been describing?
Okay. Chairman Jensen, Representative Tome. I'm relatively new, but in terms of process, the way this is conceptually going to work is when we roll out a watershed approach, Damascus, like every other city that would be physically within the watershed that they're at, as they're going into either a new permit application or going into a renewal, again, would have the opportunity to see what type of an overall allocation or load or pollutant level is going to be set for the watershed. And then based on that, there would be a process where they would be physically assigned a certain level of pollution that they could physically add into the system. And as Greg described, within how the TMDLs work, we try to provide for a margin of safety and also a margin of growth so that when you have a community like Damascus that is expanding in the whole Happy Valley area and things of that nature, that is going to be built in physically to the equation so that whenever they upgrade their system and improve their overall permit or come up with a new permit, that measure of growth is going to be included within that. Greg, I don't know if you have something you want to add. Is that helpful?
Somewhat. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a couple of closing questions slash comments. First, perhaps question. This is not, I realize, the Ways and Means Committee, but what portion of DEQ's budget, just kind of as a ballpark sort of thing, is your efforts on the Oregon Plan and TMDLs constitute?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's 34 positions, but if I can clarify and get back to you with that answer, and actually the dollar total and percentage of budget.
Could you
get
Sandy the information?
Yes.
She can share it then with us.
I apologize for not having that with me.
And the reason that I'm asking that, as I note in OEB's report to the governor and this committee and others, that 2003-2-3, that the combined total expenditures for the Oregon plan was $96,202,893. And I would respectfully submit that that is approximately 1,603 teachers, or at 30 students per classroom, 53.4 classrooms. This is not inconsequential dollars that we're talking about. And I don't know from what from your discussion and where you've been that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And I'm not making any accusations or accusing you all of anything with this, but it kind of looks like guaranteed annual employment. And that's okay, but I get back to the other first question that I have. At least I need, before I'm comfortable with this, something measurable that we're getting out of it. You know, I need to know we get six more fish. You know, or whatever it is. I need to know that this, statistically the rate of thyroid problems goes down by, some percentage. As a health type of thing. There's got someplace here to be something measurable that we can get our hands on to tell us whether what we're doing is a legitimate expenditure as far as the people's resources. And I know I was very much a part of the formation of the Oregon Plan, and I support all of those things. But when we go to the public, and when the public comes to us, we have to be able to say that this is what we're getting, and this is therefore why it is worthwhile for us to spend these dollars. Okay. If you have any comment to that, that's fine. I didn't mean it as a question. It was more of a...
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the comments. I think the best thing that we can offer at this point is to make sure that we get back to you with some a little bit more detailed information where budget dollars are and try to provide you with maybe more of a measurable understanding of what we're hoping to gain out of the implementation of this program.
And I appreciate that. And I appreciate that we, partly we're in the formulative year, even though it seems like they've gone by rather rapidly here. But I think we need to start looking at, some other things that we might start to measure and evaluate, some other long-term, objectives,
okay,
other than just the fact we got all of our TMDLs done, and we're going to review each one of them every 5 years, sort of thing. You know. Okay.
Right. Thank you.
I appreciate very much your presentations, and thank you very much, you know, for being here and taking the time and listening to my tirade.
Thank you very much.
Stand at ease for just a second while the division. You know, has to do with the issue. It comes from my constituency, and that has is the agency has adopted a very low human consumption rate for toxicity in fish. And my constituents, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, have historically consumed some 20 times the amount or more of fish that the agency has looked at when you looked at the issue of toxicity. Do you have any plans to revisit this, or do you have... What am I supposed to tell my constituents?
Okay. Mr. Chair, again, Jim McCauley, DEQ. Status on that item is we're currently in conversations, DEQ is, with the governor's office as well as the Confederated Tribes in a government-to-government conversation, looking at those toxicity levels and those consumption rates that were established or at least introduced back in May. And I think this is going to be a continued dialogue with the tribes, and I can't offer anything more than that in terms of a timeline other than to say that we're continuing to have the dialogue, and as early as Monday this week, we had some additional conversations with the tribal council and members.
And I'm somewhat aware of that. I just needed to inquire for the record on that. Thank you very much. Appreciate your answer, and appreciate the department's continuing the inquiry here, and would like to encourage you to continue to work with the tribes as best you can and as best they can on this issue. And I suppose I would also suggest there may be others that fall into the same category as the Native American populations with that.
Yes,
thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Apologize for calling you back for that.
Not a problem.
Okay, we'll close the overview informational meeting from the Department of Environmental Quality and open the informational meeting with the Department of State Lands on the Oregon Plan. And we have Jim Lilly, the Assistant Director, and Eric Metz. Excuse me. The Regulation Policy Specialist with DSL. And we seem to not have the appropriate screen for you, Jim. Stand at ease for a second. Who's going to? Okay, again.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director with the Department of State Lands. It's a pleasure to be before you today. We wanted to bring to you an overview of the Department of State Lands, first in a very capsulized form of what the department is about, and then secondly, following up in a more detailed manner on the overview of the removal field program specifically. Finally, Eric Metz, policy analyst, will go into a little bit more detail about some Oregon Plan measures and some of the work that we've been doing with the other agencies on Oregon Plan. DSL's mission is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property estates, and the Common School Fund. The purpose of the agency is to manage Common School Fund assets, that is, land and waterways granted to the state at statehood, unclaimed property and estates, and to protect and conserve wetlands and waterways. We also have responsibilities to manage the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve near Charleston, and have the legislature has also assigned us responsibility to oversee the activities of the Natural Heritage Advisory Program. I'd like to get into a little bit more detail about the department's activities themselves, particularly as it relates to land management. The land board is the Secretary of State, the State Treasurer, and, of course, the Governor. The three highest elected officials in the state are our policymaking board. The land board operates management of its state lands under the direction of the Oregon Constitution, which is reproduced for you here on the screen. This slide covers and depicts some of the land management activities that we are involved with as a land managing agency. In a nutshell, the department manages about 800,000 acres of submerged and submersible land, including the territorial sea and the beds and banks of navigable waters and lakes. In addition, the department manages in the neighborhood of 700,000 acres of uplands, including 80,000 acres of the Elliott State Forest and about 640,000 acres of rangeland in southeast Oregon in Klamath Lake, now here in Harney Counties. The cartoon here depicts some of the activities that we're involved with that derive revenue that is then deposited in the Common School Fund. For example, we do a lot of easements that occur across our land. So gas lines, electric transmission lines, water lines and such are pay a fee to cross state lands. Those are lands managed by the department. Telecommunication sites are another. The headquarters building that we occupy just down the street here is an asset of the Common School Fund. And while the department staff occupies part of the first floor, the remaining two floors are rented out to other state agencies. Fiber optic cables coming onto Oregon shore from offshore pay an easement fee to come across the territorial seabed. In addition, we have a very active program of collecting revenue from sand and gravel royalties when those commodities are removed from the beds of state-owned waterways. And then, of course, we have marinas and houseboat moorages and log raft facilities and such, where those facilities are located on state-owned submerged and submersible lands, and those revenues are also deposited in this Common School Fund. The Common School Fund is made up of basically two types of sources, the constitutional sources and the statutory sources. The constitutional sources consist of the revenues derived from lands that were dedicated to the state at the time of statehood, basically the remnants or the lands in lieu of the sections 16 and 36s that came to the state, and of which we still have somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 to 700,000 acres. Statutory revenues are those revenues derived from the management of the beds and banks of navigable waters and such. Those revenues are used to pay for statutory programs such as the state's removal fill program that we'll speak of a little later. The Common School Fund principal today is amounts to about $911 million. The land board, through a distribution policy, allows for distributions twice a year to the schools through the counties. And we've just released our estimates for the next 12 months. And in June of 2006, we will distribute almost $23 million to the counties for the schools. And then in December of this next year, another $22.8 million. Moving along, why do we have a state removal fill program? What I want to do is segue here.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Before we move on, I would like to ask a question about your comments about state lands. You indicated that in lieu of Section 16 and 36, something about state lands, and the connection wasn't clear to me, and I'm wondering, as part of that, I know we accumulated state lands in the past, if we still own some of those sections 16 and 36 or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's an excellent question. For that, I need to do a little history lesson for all of us. Of course, when Oregon became a state in 1859, the federal government had not completed surveys of the entire state, and so we didn't know where sections 16s and 36s were. And as a result, when the government land office was able to complete the surveys over a period of 50 years, they found that some of those 16s and 36s had already been occupied by settlers, or they had been all promised by the federal government to someone else, an Indian tribe, been reserved for a national forest or such. So those lands, those section 16s and 36s weren't available to the state to sell or to even to continue management. And so the Admission Act says that we could acquire other lands in lieu of those others if they weren't available. And interestingly, and I'm glad you raised this point, up until the late 60s, we thought we were pretty well fully selected. In other words, we had selected all the lands that were available to the state. A lawsuit was put in place against the federal government by some parties out of Southern Oregon who felt that there was more land owed to the state. And over a period of 25 years in the early 90s, this lawsuit was settled, and the state, in favor of the state of Oregon and these parties, to the extent that another 5,200 acres is available to the state of Oregon. And since that time, we've been working to select additional federal lands. These would be Bureau of Land Management, public domain lands, and we're in the process of selecting those lands and adding them to our Common School Fund assets to manage for the benefit of the Common School Fund.
Okay. And if follow-up, I mean, and then to answer my question, do we still have some of the 16 and 36 section lands, or have all of them been accumulated into larger tracts right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we still own some sections 16 and 36s, but we've also traded some of those, principally in to make the Elliott State Forest and to make up the large blocks of land that we have in southeast Oregon that make up the large rangeland tracts out there. So we've gotten out of, to some extent, we've gotten away from the checkerboard pattern of ownership in order to consolidate our management in a way that's more efficient in larger blocks.
Thank you.
While I've spent a little bit of time talking about the state's Division of State Lands or Department of State Lands responsibility vis-a-vis land management, what we'd really like to spend some time with you this afternoon is talking about the regulatory program that the department also runs called the Removal Fill Program. We have a removal fill program in the state of Oregon because we feel it's important to protect, conserve, and make the best use of the water resources of the state, which include water, the aquatic life and habitat that's in that water, and the other natural resource values that go along. To do that, we're also looking at minimizing flood hazards and improving water quality while we're implementing this program of regulation. The idea here is to provide and improve the water quality, certainly not degrade it through the activities of people who are dredging and filling in waters of the state. In addition, we're looking at assuring that activities in the waters of the state, streams, estuaries, lakes, and whatnot, are not done in such a way as to prevent or interfere with the public uses of the water, be it diversion of water for beneficial uses or the use of the water for fishing or navigation or public recreation. The program at the on-the-ground level places a high priority on working with the public to avoid conflicts that exist, sometimes exist between a property owners or a project sponsor. We provide technical assistance through a number of ways, through our wetlands program, helping people identify wetlands and jurisdictional waters on their property. In addition, as a result of the last legislative session, we've had a staff person funded with the department who's helped to certify a number of the industrial sites that have been reviewed by the Economic Development Department. A couple of examples of removal fill projects. This one is in Rock Creek in Columbia County up in the northwest. In this project, the stream bank was stabilized, and at the same time, there was some fish habitat improvements that were done. This project was done under what we call an expedited permit called a general authorization. The benefits of this project, or the what this project entailed, were reshaping and revegetating about 300 feet of riverbank and placing some trees and root rods to provide for, in addition to the planting, to provide for aquatic habitat. The other project I wanted to point out is down in Southern Oregon in Jackson County, where we worked with a another applicant, a cattle company landowner who is interested in replacing their annual push-up gravel push-up dam with a fixed structure that would be an irrigation diversion structure. And so what this was able to accomplish is that we were able to screen the fish out of the irrigation ditch. We opened the applicant, through the implementation of this project, was able to open up 35 miles of salmon spawning and rearing habitat. And this was a project that required state involvement and required a removal fill permit. Overall, the removal fill program generally requires a permit or some kind of authorization from the department if people want to remove or fill material in waters of the state. And the law applies to all landowners, public or private, not just on state-owned land. There are three factors that really make up when you fall within the jurisdiction of the state's removal fill law. Those factors are location, volume, and the activity. For location, basically you need to be in a wetland or working in a wetland or in a water like a natural stream, a lake, a reservoir, the territorial sea, or things that we commonly know as natural water bodies. And some artificial water bodies are also covered by the term waters of the state. The federal government also has a program that's similar to the state's, and it's operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers under the Clean Water Act. It regulates the discharge of materials into non-navigable waters, and the term navigable is not the same term that we use in the state relative to navigability for ownership purposes, although the definitions are similar. The Corps of Engineers in the Clean Water Act responsibilities regulate activities, almost all activities in waters of the U.S., which are similar to waters of the state. A permittee is required to consult over endangered species issues. If there are endangered species present in the project area, they need a 401 certification under the Clean Water Act from the Department of Environmental Quality. And they also need a coastal zone management consistency statement from the Department of Land Conservation and Development if that project occurs within the coastal zone.
John.
And what I want to do is
John.
Yes, sir.
I know that you have a 50 cubic yard. I assume for 49 yards I don't need a permit.
That's correct.
But the feds do not have, at least according to what you have there, a cubic yard criteria.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is a distinction that occurs between state and federal law. I would point out, and I failed to mention this earlier, but under state law, there are some streams where there is a zero cubic yard tolerance. So, and those streams are those that have been identified as essential salmon habitat. These are streams that are have been identified for spawning and rearing of state or federally listed anadromous fish species. And that is a tough word to say altogether. Secondly,
and that 50 yards does not apply.
That's correct, except for certain exemptions that relate to agricultural activities. Secondly, there's another class of waters that has a zero cubic yard limitation with no exemptions, and that's our state scenic waterways, of which there are about 1,000 miles of those in the state, as compared with the about 17 to 20,000 miles of essential salmon habitat that exist in the state. This rather cryptic graph or diagram is our attempt to show you the differences in the way that the state and the federal government process a removal fill permit. On the left-hand side of the screen is the state's process. On the right-hand side of the screen is the Federal Corps of Engineers process under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. We use a joint application so that an applicant is able to fill out one piece of paper to trigger both of these processes. There is a dual process. We do try to track them together with the applicant, but sometimes it's not possible to do so, and I'll tell you precisely why. The Corps of Engineers in its process allows for much less information at the front end than the state does. In order to provide certainty to an applicant and to process an application at the state on the state side as quickly as possible, recently a law was implemented that allows us to require a completed application, and we review that within 30 days to determine if it's complete. If it is complete, then the law requires that we issue the permit, that we make the permit decision within 90 days after that time. So our expectation through pre-application conferences and others is that the applicant is able to put all the information that they need together at the time of the application. On the other side, the Corps of Engineers requires much less documentation at the front end, and they kind of work the project along through this process of consultation and discussion with the other federal natural resource agencies to the point where at the end of the issuance of their permit, then the project is well defined and the impacts are well known. So that's the basic difference that we find between the two programs.
Mr. Chair, I know you're wanting to move along. May I ask a quick question? I'm still back to 50 cubic yards. It just was dawning on me. That's a lot of earth. So I guess I'm just amazed that that is allowed with any kind of permit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we calculate that at about 8 dump truck loads of material. And, you know, when I go to the garden center and load up my pickup with bark dust, it would be a bunch. It would be 50 pickup loads of bark dust. That's what 50 cubic yards looks like. And it is a lot of material, but under state law, we don't regulate in most waters and wetlands unless that amount of material is being exceeded.
That is just amazing to me. Is it to you? That just is amazing to me. I guess that people are allowed to remove or do whatever along our waterways that much material. How many dump trucks full did you say?
Eight. Eight not fully loaded.
49.5. 2/3.
Without a permit.
That's a lot of troubles, Bob.
Yeah. It's not too much what?
With a automated equipment of any sort, with a tractor.
With a backhoe.
I know, just amazing. Thank you.
It'll certainly fill my yard. Small yard.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to mention a couple of other things before I turn it over to Eric. There has been, I think, some conversation around for a while about the state of Oregon being involved in what's called the State Programmatic General Permit. For short, that's SPGP. This is a project we've been working on for some time with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I spoke to this committee during the interim about this project. We're looking to having this permit issued by the Corps to the state of Oregon here yet this spring. Basically, what it would do is provide one-stop permitting for a limited type number of projects. It would also provide for the ESA coverage that those applicants need in order to qualify for the federal permit. The state of Oregon, through the Department of State Lands, would be the primary contact point. And so if a project applicant applied for one of the department's removal fill permits, we would screen that permit application to determine if it qualified for this SPGP. And if it did, we would be able to issue them one permit which would qualify them for both the state and the federal permits. We're hopeful that this is going to happen soon. If we are able to have that permit approved this spring, we will implement it in the fall, and we'll do some training with the consultant community, the public works departments, and the applicants in general around the state to help them better fill out their applications so that we can speed them through the process. Finally, I want to cover the kinds of activities that are regulated. Pretty obvious, the placement of fill material, dredging and excavation, alteration of stream banks through riprapping or erosion control, ditching and draining, things of that nature, that types of things we normally run into. We deal with a lot of stream bank erosion control projects, a lot of road projects where there are road crossings across wetlands and waterways, commercial developments in wetlands, residential subdivisions in wetlands. Those are typically the kinds of things that we deal with. Finally, there are a number of activities that are exempt. You know, I mentioned the three parameters for jurisdiction, whether it's a water of the state, whether it meets the volume criteria, and then whether the activity is regulated or not. One of the things we look at is whether the activity is an exempt activity, and here you see some types of examples of exempt activities. So with that, I'd like to pass it on to Eric. Eric Metz will give you an overview of our activities within the Oregon Plan.
Well, we go on, John. I see stump removal as a activity you regulate.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Explain the rationale of.
We do not regulate the removal of vegetation. So if someone goes and mows a wetland, or they cut the trees down in a wetland or along the water's edge in a stream, we do not regulate the removal of the vegetation. But if they remove the stump and they remove enough stumps to accumulate 50 cubic yards of the alteration of material, then we would regulate that.
Not 50 cubic yards of stumps, but of the...
It's the earth beneath the stump, yes, sir.
Okay. I mean, looking at this, it looked to me like you were concerned about the stump.
Mr. Chair, technically the stump is material, as defined under state law, but we have to exceed 50 cubic yards in other than anadromous fish streams or essential salmon habitat or scenic waterways.
Okay.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Eric Metz, Regulatory Policy Specialist with the Department of State Lands. I'd like to give you an overview of our Oregon Plan measures and some of our recent Oregon Plan activities. We have about 33 salmon and steelhead measures. Our South Slough Reserve in Charleston has four. We've completed most of our measures and or continuing some of them indefinitely. Some measures, very few of them, were not implemented either due to policy conflicts or lack of funding. Take one example. DSL Measure 1 has developed standardized permit conditions reflecting best management practices for removal fill activities. We recently completed and adopted in May of 2004 a complete comprehensive rule review where we basically clarified statutory provisions relating to definitions, relating to tests, procedures for obtaining permits, complete applications, basically a large-scale effort. We reviewed and revised standard permit condition templates internally, so when an application comes to us, we have revised and updated information that we can use to then modify if we need to, add conditions, take conditions away, and that was an internal administrative process. In association with the SPGP that John mentioned earlier, we've conducted Section 7 Endangered Species Act consultations with both the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and as a result, a great deal of additional information has been developed to avoid impacts to listed species, and that will be ultimately reflected in our permit conditions as well. Measure 2 is to limit commercial grapple removal from individual bars to annual recruitment. In order to implement this measure for any commercial gravel operator, we require that the riverbed be surveyed both pre- and post-removal, that 10 to 25-foot buffer strips between the operation and the water line be left at the time of activity. And currently, just to let you know with the magnitude, there are about 58 active status commercial gravel removal operations statewide at this time. DSL 3 was to revise the rules, as we mentioned a couple of times, on essential salmon habitat. In 1999, we did a major revision where the total increase, and this is partly due to new listings, from 4,500 miles to about nearly 18,000 stream miles. And those stream miles were based on a scale of 1 to 100,000 hydrology. So that's if it was more detailed mapping, the probably greater miles you could measure. In 2001, we made some adjustments, relatively minor adjustments, adopted updated maps, added about 217 additional miles. DSL-4 was to strengthen interagency coordination and removal fill permitting. We revised and or initiated memoranda of agreement on that topic with the State Department of Environmental Quality, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. These MOAs and other agreements and relationships we have with these agencies have better integrated our programs, and this is one of those measures that will continue indefinitely. We've also developed a separate memorandum of agreement with the Corps of Engineers to assure the smooth implementation of the SPGP. DSL 26 was to pursue regulatory streamlining. We mentioned the SPGP. We mentioned the Federal Endangered Species Act consultation already. Coordinate between DEQ and DLCD and industrial siting certification. So we're pursuing this in multiple levels.
What do you mean by industrial siting certification?
Mr. Chair, I mentioned earlier that when DSL was added to the economic revitalization team, we added a staff person that enabled us to work with local communities and property owners at reviewing their sites that had industrial siting potential. And our review consisted of determining whether or not there were wetlands on the properties and to what extent they might be needed to be mitigated if development were to occur. As a result of that work, we were helpful with economic development in certifying about 70 sites. And that means that those sites could be ready for development within 6 months or so.
I'd like to talk to you briefly about one example of some recent work we've done for the Oregon Plan Coho Assessment and the Oregon Coast Ecologically Significant Unit. We took a look at some data, some historic data from the 1800s from government land office surveys, and we found that there's been quite a bit of conversion, particularly of salt marsh and freshwater marsh in the coastal ESU. Salt marsh, about 67% of that's been converted, and about 76% of the freshwater marsh. And we estimated that the loss of total acres of wetland habitat in just that ESU, which is a good deal of the coast, is approaching 44,000 acres. This is how the numbers break down by category. We previously didn't have these numbers by category. We only had relatively crude measurements. And we've contracted with the National Wetland Inventory to do trend studies for the coast. We're developing methods to measure wetland functions and to characterize wetland types to assist us in our evaluations and our permit process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tolman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is a lacustre?
Lake. I'm sorry. That's a lake.
Thank you.
Lakes. Mm-hmm. Give you an example, illustrate what some of these types are. This is a aerial photograph of Tillamook Bay at low tide. The water you see in the channels at low tide, bounded by the mudflats, would be subtidal habitat, which wouldn't be here as a category. Then the salt marsh on the left side of the slide, you see an example of a dike with a lineal features there, dike salt marsh on the right side. That's another large salt marsh area. These would be considered lower salt marshes, the lower end of the estuary. Here we have a tidal stream that drains into Tillamook Bay, and it's been diked and cut off from the watershed. This is a alder swamp, the type of habitat that's in short supply now in this ESU. So the good news, though, is just in spite of all the question.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'm working hard to keep up with the acronyms, but I did not understand what ESU is.
Sorry, ecologically significant unit is a unit that the National Marine Fisheries Service uses to group related species of salmon so they can make some ecological sense out of it. So in the case of the coho salmon, they've said that from Kuskokwim watershed north to Tillamook watershed in the coastal basin, this is the significant unit for coho salmon. If we want to understand if they're endangered, if they can be recovered, then this is where we concentrate. And the term they use is the acronym is ESU.
And if I may follow up, I assume that ESA is ecologically a significant area,
Representative,
or is that something else?
Well, Representative Barnhart and members, ESA usually, I believe the context I'm using it, would be the Federal Endangered Species Act.
Ah, okay. Thank you. You know, it would be useful for me if, whenever possible, these terms were translated into English. And I suspect that I'm not the only one for whom that's the case.
Sorry, I'm just running over this too quickly.
Thank you.
I'll slow down. Okay, so the historic estuarine wetland loss the trend has been reversed. Estuarine wetland loss is in terms of conversion to upland, in other words, permanent loss, has been negligible during the most recent three decades. So the regulatory systems that are in place, the Clean Water Act, the state removal fill law, the state land use laws have stopped that wholesale conversion that occurred prior to the enactment of these laws. Our goals are to, along with the other state agencies, we develop and monitor performance measures to assess progress in delivering products and service to Oregonians. Goal number three is to maintain and restore wetlands. The freshwater wetlands benchmark 77A is that there should be no net loss in wetland area. And benchmark 77B is that for estuarine wetlands, there should be a net gain of 250 acres per year. And how we're doing on that is we're actually achieving the net gain in freshwater wetlands. And I'll show you a slide in a moment how that's happening. We're below target on the increase in estuarine wetlands. There is a net increase in estuarine wetlands, but it's not even approaching the 250 acres per year. This is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. This is how we calculate the no net loss. We look at 175 acres of fill that we approved in the two fiscal years from 2002 to 2004 statewide. That's all the wetland fill we approved on top of the table. As mitigation to ameliorate and lessen these impacts, compensatory wetland mitigation, we call it, we required enhancement of existing wetland, the 374 acres of existing wetland, enhancing it. And since we've enhanced existing wetland, that's not an increase in wetland. That's making existing wetland better. So we don't include that in our no-net loss calculations.
Mr. Chair.
Thank
you. I have a question, actually. It's a couple of slides back, and we brought this up during the Ways and Means process as well, so I think it would be important to make sure that the committee here has the same information. And I think you were both there for that. Under the DSL's goals, when we talked about the first performance measures under Goal 3 is for freshwater wetlands, there should be no net loss. And we also talked about net gain. And then the second one is there should be a net gain. So are we assuming there's no net loss for estuarine and that there's a net gain of 250? But what happened to the net gain in the freshwater area?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Dingfelder, my recollection is on what we discussed at the subcommittee was that we actually have shown over the last four-year period a net gain in freshwater wetlands. In fact, I think it's the most recent year was 16 acres, and prior years it was as much as 25. We're exceeding that
that target of no net loss, which is kind of a national national policy, if you will, a national standard. I think that the subcommittee some of the discussion I heard within the Ways and Means Natural Resource Subcommittee was some interest in maybe revisiting that measure and discussing whether or not it needed to be, you know, a net gain beyond just the no net loss standard for freshwater. Now, as to the estuarine, it turns out that there's a lot of interest in amongst folks in the coastal area at restoring some of these estuarine wetlands. And so our wetland conservation manager, Janet Moreland, felt that it was appropriate for the state to have a goal where we're looking at an actual increase. And we've been hopeful of achieving that. In fact, there are a number of projects on the in the planning stages that will greatly go beyond the zero level and probably get closer to our target. I think that because of the measures, or rather the information that Eric has just shown you, where there is a considerable amount of acreage that has been eliminated or converted, particularly in our estuarine habitats, there is an interest amongst folks to restore these estuarine wetlands, and they're relatively easy to do, although not without some controversy, because what we're typically doing is to get the most bang for your opportunity is to breach dikes and allow the tide to run back into these areas, these low-lying areas. Well, that removes some area from production for agriculture, and so we need to work with willing partners, obviously. And a lot of times these restoration projects are instigated by the property owners in the first place.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I guess in closing, John, how realistic is the 250 acres a year, and what are you basing it on? In other words, is it been identified through, you know, the Oregon plan or the Coho coastal assessment? Or, I mean, if we're saying we're not getting there, you know, what are we basing that number on? And I'm, you know, supportive, and I do know that's one of the most important life cycles in the salmon, salmonid, life, but. We talked about this a little bit. Where does the 250-year number come from?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, staff looked at what's the potential out there and felt that the 250 acres a year was within reach. I spoke to Janet Moreland just this afternoon before coming over here and questioned her about that again, and she continues to tell me that it's within reach. I am concerned as well that we've got a target there that seems a little bit beyond what we've been able to demonstrate thus far. I think wherever we put it, there is lots of opportunity out there, and I think there's a lot of property owners that are willing to do this kind of work.
Okay. I'm sure we'll have more discussions about this, but thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I follow up a little bit on that. I am concluding then that these numbers of X number of acres are not necessarily science-driven, but are some internal house conclusions or beliefs.
Mr. Chair, as to the 250 acres per year for estuarine wetland restoration, those are best professional judgment from staff.
Okay.
That's correct.
So they're staff-driven.
Yes, sir. And they've been approved by the Oregon Progress Board. That is what the Oregon benchmarks depict.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Progress Board. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So as I mentioned earlier, in terms of claiming no net loss, we don't count the enhancement because it's the same amount of wetland on the ground that there was after you do the project as it was before the project. But we do count creation because there you're taking upland and converting it into wetland. And we count restoration because there you're taking former wetland that's no longer wetland and you're restoring it back to wetland. So when we add the creation and the restoration acres and subtract the fill from it, we still came out ahead 35 acres. That's why we're saying that there's no net loss in freshwater wetlands. That's how we can claim to have achieved that goal. I'd like to talk about some of the importance of that we believe that the early some of the early science, and this is hasn't been nailed down by the scientific community definitively, but some of the early indications are that the protection of the upper reaches of estuaries, you showed you in some of those slides earlier, Tillamook Bay, for example, that tidal rivers and sloughs that drain down into them be considered the upper reach of the estuaries, where the fresh and salt water mix, creating brackish water, transitional habitats. Those areas are very important for increasing the productivity of estuaries for juvenile coho salmon. And these take the form of lowland beaver ponds. I mentioned the transitional marshes, upper estuarine salt marshes, and the corridors linking those habitats together are also important. So future challenges are that our current data, although this data that we developed for the coho assessment is far superior to that we had historically, it still doesn't distinguish between the ecological functions of the original wetland versus the wetland that exists today, either mitigated wetland or converted wetland. We are working on that, or working on scientific endeavors to solve that, but it doesn't exist yet. So converting, again, one wetland type to another in and of itself doesn't result in a net gain. So our data don't provide information about the significance of any of the wetland changes for coho. They could be good, they could be bad. Since coho decreased, certainly it's played a role. We can't quantify it, how big a role it's played. So what's next for the future? Future of the Oregon plan, as we move in the, away from the assessment of are the coho viable in the ESU, which the state has determined they in fact are viable in the ecologically significant unit. Therefore, they're not at risk of becoming extinct in the state's opinion. And this is partly due to, we know that the existing regulatory programs have addressed the habitat factor for decline effectively. But there's a need now to shift focus towards a relative scarcity of stream complexity, which the state has identified as one of the highest priority concerns for recovering the fish. This would involve, among other things, restoring and enhancing existing habitat to create more complex stream systems. And we need to identify and establish high-quality habitat that supports overwintering juvenile coho. So I'll turn it back to John to wrap it up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that pretty much concludes our presentation, and we'd be very pleased to take any questions that you have.
Other questions? Mm-hmm. Okay. I run into a question on the last slide, and I'm curious of the source. Need to identify and establish high-quality habitat that supports overwintering juvenile coho salmon. Is that a need that... where did that come from, I guess, is my question.
That was one of our agency's recommendations as a next step to take for coho recovery.
That was one of whose?
Our agency's.
Your agency?
Yes, based upon the scientific literature.
Okay. Was there any input or observations from the IMST regarding this issue?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the IMST has just now been reviewing this work, and they and others have been reviewing and still have an opportunity to comment before it gets submitted to National Marine Fisheries Service. I have not been involved in the interaction with the IMST to date on it,
okay,
personally.
Okay. One of the other questions I have, coming off the report, Division of State Lands said monitored 5% of the permits it issued this biennium, and approximately 70% of the permits were in compliance.
The other way, of course, to say that is approximately 30% were not in compliance. And could you talk to me about the not in compliance?
I think the summary report.
OWEB report.
What?
This is in the OWEB report.
This is in the, yes, OWEB report.
Okay.
What page?
Page 37. First column, halfway down, just above water quality restoration.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 5% is an error. We've monitored more than that. I don't have the data with me. Maybe I do.
You can get back.
Would you like to get
to
we
us
can
on
do
that,
sir.
If you want to, Eric can talk.
Let me speak to compliance monitoring specifically and generally to your question, I guess. The department has a program whereby we do monitor, that means visit and assess the permitted projects each year. We can't visit each one because we issue somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 or so permits annually. So we concentrate on those that we think are critically important to look at. So it turns out that we get to about 10% annually. We go on a pass-fail basis. We have a list of standards that we're looking at, basically the permit conditions and the permit itself. And we go out and look to see if we can determine whether or not the project was built according to plans. And if we're out there at a time when the project was under construction, whether or not the permit conditions during operating are being followed. If any one of the conditions is not met, then that project isn't in compliance. Now, we have a higher rate of compliance with stream projects than we do with wetlands projects, and there's a good reason for that. Turns out that a wetland permit is a lot more complex because it oftentimes requires compensatory wetland mitigation, which means somebody has got to go out and enhance, create, or restore a wetland. If they're doing that work, then they may be doing it on a site other than where the project is being done. So we need to go to that site, and we need to see and make sure that from year to year, over a period of 5 years, that project is going along well enough to be successful and to being what it was intended to do according to the permit conditions and what the applicant said they would do. So if, for example, the applicant fails to send in their monitoring report in a particular year, then they would be deemed to be out of compliance, even though they may have done the work and et cetera. So it's a pass-fail type of operation.
Thank you. Appreciate that, a little bit of update. Let me speak to, and I didn't mean to surprise you because it is my understanding that this data would be provided to OWEB by the agency. Otherwise, I don't know where they would, be getting the numbers. And it is this annual report from OWEB is our, that is the legislature's, right, or biannual report, is the legislature's and the, some extent even the governor's office way of assessing the value and merit of the Oregon plan. I don't know that in the historical past that we have been necessarily diligent enough in the legislature in following up and reviewing this, and particularly reviewing it with the agencies, as I've been kind of, trying to do today. But hopefully this will help us fine-tune this process so that in future legislatures and at future times we'll have our everybody kind of know what the expectations are on it, and I certainly would recognize that this might have been in some ways a little bit of a curveball And if so, I hope you will not take offense with it, because it is simply our way that we have to have something to be able to start to even get some ideas to be able to make assessments on. And this was the way the statute set it up, and hopefully the way that we'll use it in the future. So if there's nothing else for the good of the order, I would like very much to thank you for your presentation. I would also thank you for your indulging the chair of his idiosyncrasies, and we will at that point close the meeting for today.